This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
We all know that our well-being is important, and the focus on our well-being has never been analysed so deeply thanks to the last couple of years. But, Warwick Long, what has our well-being got to do with the economy?
This is an interesting question for me, Rochelle, too, because it's like, what's government for? Because governments obviously are in control of a lot of the levers around our economy. And it, should the government consider our happiness or our well-being when making laws, particularly around the economy? Or should it just be thinking in the numbers? Are we going to have, is our budget situation going to be better off? Are we going to send the country broke? Is this doing something within the country's benefit? And I'd like to imagine many people driving right now looking at the radio are either shaking their head saying, no, government, absolutely not. Or, yes, of course the government should be involved in considering our happiness as well. I think it's probably something we don't all agree on.
It's interesting, though, because I guess what we're talking about is a well-being budget and a well-being economy. Now, this is an area where around the world more and more research is being done. But I guess fundamentally what a well-being economy is, isn't how can I make people happier? It's looking, which is what it sort of sounds like on the surface, which is why I think a lot of people roll their eyes, like Jos Frydenberg did back in 2020. We'll play some of that in just a moment. It's looking at how can we connect the dots between our well-being and the state of our economy. So not necessarily whether we're happy or not, that might come into it, but our general health, I guess work-life balance, whether or not we have access to things like childcare, do we have access to things like health, do we have access to things like dental care, all of those things wrapped around into what makes up a rounded life. Does that have an, if things were easier and better, would that have an impact on the economy? I don't know.
Is one person's well-being budget, though, another person's middle-class welfare? Because when we talk well-being, are we talking the happiness of, like, the more affluent members of the society? Is it a luxury that we're talking about here? Or, and is it the place of government should be trying to lift up or help the people who are most adversely affected or in the most difficult circumstances in the state or the federal as well? And is that well-being? Is it that well-being? Or are we looking at things through different prisms here? And do the labels matter? I'm looking forward to all of this today.
Well, in 2020, Jim Chalmers was absolutely mocked in Parliament, right, when he flagged the idea at the time, the Labor government's, their intent to introduce a well-being budget. So then the Treasurer was Jos Frydenberg, and this is how he reacted to the idea of a well-being budget.
Well, we know those opposite prefer well-being budgets to balanced budgets, Mr. Speaker. And I was thinking yesterday, as the member for Rankin was coming into the chamber, fresh from his ashram deep in the mountains of the Himalayas, barefoot into the chamber, robes flowing, incense burning, beads in one hand, well-being budget in the other, I thought to myself, what would the yoga position that the member for Rankin would assume?
The Treasurer.
So the difference is now Jim Chalmers is the Treasurer and he is intending to include well-being in the budget when it's delivered in a couple of months. There is a lot of work and research globally going into a well-being economy. There's already one that's been introduced in the ACT. New Zealand, a couple of years ago, introduced a well-being budget, and Scotland has one as well. But the jury is out as to whether or not it's made a difference, well, to people's well-being or to the economy. I mean, I'm not sure what the focus is. Is it getting the economy better by making people's well-being better? Or if the economy's better, is our well-being naturally better?
It sounds like a Freakonomics question, really, isn't it? How do we put numbers into something that's sort of from the social aspect of life? God, clips from Parliament never make you feel good about how laws are created in this country, do they, Rochelle? But thank you very much for sharing that. Anyway, it also, though, did make me think of that part of the world, because Bhutan, which is around the Himalayas as well, they obviously, and had quite, it's been quite debated widely, well known, that they have a gross national happiness index and health
index. See, that's when I roll my eyeballs was. Happiness that. Index, I'm almost, you know, feel like Frydenberg in that sense where I'm like, well, what's a happiness index? But is that just in the marketing?
That's not achieved by going around everybody in the country and asking if you're happy or not, although I do like that idea in a random way too. But it does have a number of things behind it to decide if the laws and if the country itself is in a position to make sure its residents are happy or not. And I think that's something we need to look at today. Is it something we should look at, or is it all going to make us roll our eyes and bring up images of whatever we think the latest wellbeing fad is as a way of sort of talking it down? Let's go through that.
So what is a wellbeing economy? How does it affect policy? How does it affect our own wellbeing? How does it affect our climate and the environment? Is a wellbeing budget all just incense and yoga poses? Or is wellbeing and the economy linked?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
Never.
Can we wish ourselves well, Warwick Long, or do we need to put wellness into the budget?
Yeah, Rochelle Hunt in Melbourne, our Minister for Happiness today on the program. Warwick Long in Shepparton, I'm your Minister for Wellbeing. We will go through this and decide if this is an important part of the economy or if it is something that is said to make us feel good but doesn't really change much. All that much in our lives.
Or would you like to see wellness put into our budget, into the economy? Is this something that you've thought about, and what would it look like? Dr. Catherine Trebeck, well, she's a political economist, she's a writer, she's an advocate for economic system change. She co-founded the Wellbeing Economy Alliance and is also behind We All in Scotland, somewhere where they already have a wellbeing budget. Dr. Trebeck, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. How linked is our wellbeing and the economy?
Hi, thanks ever so much for having me. And it's absolutely massively linked, because I like to think about wellbeing not so much as individual happiness, that sort of temporary state of, you know, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10. I like to think about wellbeing as a really rich form of quality of life in all its dimensions, things like connection, opportunity, agency, and now and in the future. So it's absolutely got the environment, quality of ecosystems at its core. It's things like decent jobs, is work paying enough, how people's housing, their health. And if you think about it, the economy is a root cause of so many of those questions. So if we're then thinking about a wellbeing economy, at its simplest, Rochelle, it's about an economy that's designed deliberately and proactively to deliver what people and planet need, essentially an economy that serves humanity rather than the other way around.
Have we not been doing this already, just without the wellbeing tag?
Well, of course, governments look at a wide range of measures, but so often what trumps decision-making is this idea of get the economy growing big. Often that's measured by gross domestic product. We look at some fairly traditional economic measures, which all absolutely have their place. But so often that range of considerations hasn't been broad enough to get a full picture of how people's quality of life is. You were talking earlier, Warwick, about the distribution of those outcomes. How are the poorest people doing? How are those people who are struggling on minimum wages or in casual work? How are they going? People who are struggling with housing affordability. And just we've seen in Australia that decades of economic growth, successful in GDP terms though that may be, hasn't delivered for enough people. And we're also seeing, and you know, recent weeks just proved that model of economic development is also putting huge pressure on the planet. That's putting people's quality of life at risk as well. And so we need to take a good hard look at the way the economy is operating, who's winning and who's losing out of it, and ask some big questions around, are our measures such as GDP fit for purpose in the 21st century? How can we bring out the best of business? So they're part of the solutions as well. How do we maybe need to rethink the tax system so that it encourages the sort of behaviours we need more of in an economy that serves people and planet?
So is it something, though, that's aimed at making more affluent members feel good? Wellbeing is something that they've probably got the money and the luxury to start thinking about their place in the world and their life, as opposed to a budget and economy that does consider some of those sort of less well-off members of society. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the best things about a wellbeing budget is the opportunity to disaggregate about results, to really understand how different groups in society are faring. How are women doing, for example? How are people in different parts of Australia faring? How are the poorest? What's their situation like? And what do they need more of to be able to lift themselves up and contribute and participate more in Australian society? So I'd say it's absolutely squarely focused on delivering for those who are, to be quite honest, not being well served by the current setup. So it is, has got that sense of bringing about more equality and more fairness at its heart.
It feels like if we were ever going to have this conversation seriously, now is the time to do it, because there is just so much stress and uncertainty within our economy that obviously has a huge impact on all of our well-being. Dr. Catherine Trebeck is with you. Let's have a chat to Danny, who's called in Hawthorn. Hi, Danny. This is an area of interest for you.
Yes, absolutely. So I've done quite a lot of work in this area. I actually did a PhD in something very related to it. I'm really interested to see how government rolls this out, because you can do it just as greenwashing, choose the wrong measures, as I think has been highlighted there. You could choose things that are interested to people who are already doing quite well, or you can choose measures that have real impact on the lower socioeconomic groups across the state, and equally balancing across everybody.
And Danny, just on that, since you've studied it so intensely, what are the pitfalls then? What do you say are the biggest risks when someone's deciding to go, or a government's deciding to go down this path?
I guess the risks are that they just make it a communication exercise, that it's the equivalent of what you see of corporate greenwashing, where they talk all sorts of environmental outcomes, but actually do very little. It has the opportunity to really change the way that decisions are made. And that's really was the basis of kind of my research in the area.
Yeah. And Danny, you're not the only one researching this. Thank you. There's a text here that says that I'm doing my third unit in wellbeing as a part of my education degree. Wellbeing is so much more than happiness. It's social, emotional, spiritual. Children who do not have a healthy wellbeing do not succeed across the board. So I think that wellbeing is essential for good economics. If people do want to exceed this, if people do not succeed, the country doesn't succeed. And a little later, we'll be speaking to a social worker who believes totally in this, that we've got to start with the kids and we need to teach well-being right from the beginning.
Gosh, Rochelle, those comments from Danny reminds me of a preview. Remember when we did the show on HR and how people deal with HR? And everyone was ringing and complaining, saying, oh, our company would say we're an equal opportunity employer, or we're doing this. And then you get down to the bolts of it after all the motherhood statements, I suppose. When it got into practice, that's when the difficulties rise. Dr. Catherine Trebeck's with you, political economist, writer, advocate for economic system change. Is that one of the worries for you if we go down the idea of a well-being economy?
Washing.
well-being washing.
Yeah, I think it is a risk. And you do see examples of companies sort of doing Tai Chi in the car park while making huge numbers of workers redundant, or putting more pressure on them to work more hours or more intensively. I mean, it's sort of, they're missing the point fundamentally there. But I couldn't agree with Danny more, because there is a huge opportunity that Australia has now to really step into this conversation. And the budget that we're hearing about for October, I think, is an important first step there. And the budget is a juncture. I mean, I actually think often the policy-making suite behind it probably matters more. But where the budget really comes into its own is, one, that it can shape the economy literally through the tax incentives to encourage sort of behaviours we want more of in Australia. And I don't think we talk about that enough here. Mm. And, of course, it also funds projects and services. And I think if we're really honest with ourselves, so much of what government money goes to is driven by the failure to create good lives and protect the planet. Yes. I mean, so much rebuilding after floods, for example, or stress and anxiety treatments because people feel they've got precarious lives.
So but you just really mentioned services there as well. And another program that we did, which was probably one of, to be honest, one of the most emotional programs I've ever did, which was access to dental care, and that how most of us just don't have access. Going to the dentist now is a privilege. It's expensive. And the ongoing impact that has on not only your emotional well-being, but your financial well-being as well. This is something, I guess, that Ormond, you would agree with.
It's a lovely example, actually, of how interconnected so many of these aspects are, and we cannot just see them in isolation. And I think the conversation you're talking about there is one around what are the services we want to provide universally. I mean, we're good on education being provided universally, maybe, you know, rolling out dental services, given that we know the impact they have on people's lives, their ability to work, their ability to be good parents and engage in the community, is an example of the sort of upstream wider thinking that this agenda really paves the way for. And so it's a really, really good example, a sort of microcosm of how this lens can give us a wider frame of reference and start to see those interconnections, but also the opportunity to roll out what people would describe as co-benefits or multi-benefits. So, for example, you get things right in the dental services, you're going to see kids doing better in their classrooms, people be better at work. And so all these things are interconnected. And that's I think, the beauty of this conversation. It helps us look upstream and understand all the root causes, but also the opportunities to really bring about wider change.
Let's just have a chat. We'll go to Ararat. Ormond, you're agreeing here, and dental care is a huge part of, I guess, changes you would like to see that includes wellbeing.
Oh, yes, most definitely. I have suffered from lack of dental care for years because I can't afford it. I've been to the local hospital, which is hopeless. I've had a denture made there, which is just, you couldn't wear it. I went to my mother's dentist in Geelong. He took one look at it and said, throw it in the bin. Now, the point of all this is, there's a lot of people out there who can't afford dental care, and yet we have a government who's running around giving away free light bulbs. Previous to that were these power-saving things to connect to your TV and video, and I used to do antenna installations, and I was driven silly after the installation of them.
And that's their pointless when actually what you need them. Yeah, is dental care 100%. I mean, I guess this is the thing, Catherine, isn't it, when we talk about a wellbeing budget or a wellbeing economy. At the end of the day, people like Ormond in Ararat need dental care. So how can we connect the two when people just need services?
So, and I think a lot of those services are a key part of supporting people's wellbeing, but a lot of those services can often be driven by the failure of the current economic system to deliver good lives for people the first time around. And so things like your low energy light bulbs, if they are contributing to protecting our planet, that then is reducing the impact of climate change, you can see the link there on people's quality of life. We know that if people don't have, say, jobs that pay enough to put food on the table, or if they're having to work three jobs because they're part of the casual labour market, if they can't afford housing or can't struggling with their mortgage or to pay the rent, if there's not enough room for their kids to do their homework, or their home is at risk of bushfire or flood, their quality of life, their opportunities, their connection, their agency is not going to be that high. And so essentially this conversation has to be about taking a good hard look at how we've designed the economic system and is it in service of people's well-being. And so, yes, it's often about government provision, but it's also about saying how can we get the economy to do more of the heavy lifting and being part of that conversation rather than getting the government to step in at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and try to patch up and heal some of that damage that's been done. So it's a much richer, more upstream conversation that this begs of us.
Dr. Catherine Trebeck, thanks very much for kickstarting this conversation with us today.
Such a pleasure.
The co-founder of the Wellbeing Economy Alliance and also We All Scotland, Dr. Catherine Trebeck there. Is a wellbeing budget and is wellbeing and the economy linked for? Let's go to Elizabeth, who's calling from New South Wales. Elizabeth, welcome aboard.
Oh, thank you. Look, on the news, yet again, it was reported that there's a lack of rural GPs.
Yes.
There's a lack of GPs in city areas. We can't have happiness and welfare, appropriate welfare, if we can't get those medical services. When you're sick, you're not happy. So my suggestion is perhaps that instead of these young training doctors specialising and choosing to do that, they would get a very broad base for their specialty. If they had if it was mandated that they serve in rural and less
which
exclusive,
it's sort of. I mean, it was in Victoria, but that's all just changed recently and is set to change again. I think within the next couple of months. And Warwick Long, you'd probably know more about this than me, but I know there's been significant changes as well to international doctors and training doctors and the placements and the funding that they'll receive to be in rural and regional Victoria. And instantly, it's had a huge impact on regional Vic.
It's one of the great frustrations of living in a regional area is access to health services. And it's one of the big things. You and I have had this conversation so often in the past, Rochelle, about one of the pitfalls of moving to the country when we're saying a lot of people during COVID are moving to regional areas, access to doctors, access to hospitals, access to key healthcare, not sitting in emergency overnight. You know, some people drive to Melbourne from Shepparton because they know the emergency wait's going to be less after a 2-hour drive to the city. So you hear these frustrations a lot, and it's really interesting watching that come in on our text line today too. People saying, well, where have you spending all these billions on submarines? Oh, if you're spending dollars on light bulbs, it's insert government policy you might not believe in here, and also it put it against your frustrations with the health services that are currently being delivered to you. It goes to show the health minister and the bureaucracy behind it at state and federal level is probably a really difficult job, but such an important job in government and for our well-being.
So if there's to be a well-being budget, if we were to live in a well-being economy, what are the basics that need to change and the services that you would like to see and that interconnection between just our general health and our well-being and the access that you have to all of those basics, whether it be dental, whether it be childcare, or whether it be mental health services as well.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Rochelle Hunt with you in Melbourne, Warwick Long with you in Shepparton. Lots of people talking about their well-being and that connection to dental treatment. This text, I haven't had dental treatment for 25 years. It's a choice between putting food on the table or paying for the dentist. But another was, this is interesting, right? Everyone sort of has their own labels for maybe what a well-being economy looks like. Some people here saying, you know, you should speak to Dr. Lynn Reeder, who's working on a steering group for Ballarat Health Services. She's trying to create a strategy to make Ballarat a compassionate city. So I wonder what a compassionate city means. And again, right, I don't want to be cynical, but that's generally how I roll. Are we being, you know, well-being washed? Is it just a form of titles, and is it just words? When at the end of the day, people are waiting for their teeth to fall out so that they can get dentures because they can't afford to go to the dentist.
It's one of the great frustrations, isn't it? I know during the drought and even with bushfires and so forth, reporting there was a lot of frustration that started to get thrown at the word resilience, because every forum, every program, every shiny piece of paper that was delivered to your mailbox had something about resilience on it. Now, the idea about resilience and building it and helping people with it is a good one, right? But when it's just this shiny label that's not delivered upon, then the frustration rises. And maybe that's something that we need to be talking about here when we talk about a well-being budget and a well-being economy.
Dr. Michelle Maloney is a lawyer and systems change advocate. She co-founded the New Economy Network of Australia. And Michelle, a lot of your work into the new economy and what that could look like is coming from a focus of our environment and our climate. How interconnected is our well-being and the climate? Which sounds like a really stupid question now that that's come out of my mouth. Because they're very connected.
Look, to be honest, the New Economy Network Australia wasn't just founded for environment or climate change reasons. NENA is a network, just ordinary people in small businesses or social enterprises or across community gardens or in little country towns. We've got people all around Australia, thousands of people and something like 500 members. We're just a humble cooperative. We don't have any funding. We're run by volunteers. But we're all concerned about two things. Number one, we have an economy that's no longer fit for purpose. It's not providing the basic resources and support for ordinary human beings in our country. And number two, it's actually making climate change worse. Our economy, I think this year, the Australia Institute in March, in its sort of annual assessment of where all the money goes, it estimates that $11.6 billion in spending and tax breaks supports the fossil fuel industry. So government money supporting industries that are killing the planet and, in fact, not providing as many jobs as people would think, because, in fact, everyone's talking about dental care and other things. Of course, our health is the most important thing for most people, and we've done the assessment for regions all around Australia, and the biggest slice of economic activity in any country town, city or bioregion is health. It's always bigger than all the other so-called important industries like mining and extractivism. So we have an economy or an economic system that values the wrong things. What I'm interested in and why many of us are committed to the New Economy Network is to help ordinary people and folks who are out there doing their jobs, doing their businesses, trying to do positive social change, talking about the economy more. The economy is not a magical entity created by government and we're all sort of on the outside.
It feels very out there, the economy, doesn't it? Like we have no control over the economy.
We've been told that by corporate interests and by many government folks. They like to talk in a way that makes other people feel excluded. They think they're in charge. And I'll be really brutally honest here. Most governments, government entities think they're at the centre of the universe and we're all these extra stakeholders, and it's ridiculous. We are the economy. Every single one of us on this continent build the economy every single day, not just with what we buy, but what we do for each other. And there's a whole nother series of thinking around community economies, which shows that most of the so-called economic activity that matters to us is in the care economy. It's in how we look after our kids, our mums, our elderly. And I grew up in a country town in the middle of Queensland in the 80s, and health services then were bloody neglected, you know? So Nina is really interested in being sort of democratising these conversations about what an economy should look like and where the money should go. We're engaging with the wonderful work of We All International, but we're also connecting to all the good ideas, community and diverse economy.
But I just wonder, and we'll get back to this in a moment, it all sounds incredible, right? And everything that you're saying, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are nodding their heads and saying, yes, of course we are the economy, but how much of a say do we have / should we have? And you would hope that those that are in charge at any given time are the ones that are best positioned to keep the economy going, which in turn helps our well-being and our health. Just stay with us, Michelle, because we want to have a chat to Val, who's in Carnegie. G'day, Val.
Hi. Hi, I love your program. Now, I just wanted to take it a step backwards because until now we've been talking about capital H health. I want to talk about small H health, which is what I call about people connecting to each other and people feeling good about connection, and therefore, you know, you almost feel, oh, I can do this. Now, for that to happen, I think we really need to scrutinize what's going on at a local level. Lots of local LGAs or municipalities have spaces that are not well used for their community. There needs to be an audit of how these places are used. There are sections of people, and you all have mentioned them, but I will focus maybe on the older person. I hate saying elderly, on the older person. I was just saying to the person who answered the phone, just in the last year, because it's a natural thing, you tend to make friends, you have friends who are similar age to you or slightly older or something like that. In the last year, because of all sorts of social circumstances, 6 people have literally dropped out of my life.
Yeah. And I guess you're looking at the idea too of community and loneliness. And loneliness is another area that we've started to take that seriously now as well. And whereas previously we'd just be like, well, you know, they're lonely, maybe go visit them. But what if you start to break down loneliness and the health benefits for that? I think Val's right.
How do you measure that though? How does that affect, how does that work into the economy? How does that become something that's in a well-being budget, which we're talking about today, that the laws are made by people? And, you know, I don't know what the answer is to that.
Dr. Michelle Maloney is with you as well. Michelle, how do we, I guess, make this all work? So, yes, on paper, communities should have more say. We so often, you know, come to an end of a program here
but
on the Conversation.
Don't communities have their say already? We vote.
No,
we vote for
I
the
don't
people
think
that
so.
Create the laws,
no.
don't we?
When we're talking about a solutions-driven community, right, how often do, even yesterday when we were talking about older women and housing, there were multiple community groups that are saying, we've got the solution, just give us the funding. So are the right people getting the right money? The communities often have the solution, but they're never given the power.
I would agree with that. And so just quickly from our point of view, one, we are trying to do a couple of things inside NENA, the New Economy Network, make people aware that they're part of the economy and not to feel disempowered, to connect with other people because we are a network. If you want to even just jump on our mailing list, visit the website, neweconomy.org.au. We have different hubs of folks looking at different issues. And within each sector or within each place, so we look across sectors and we look from place-based approaches, how people can connect with others, have conversations, share their good ideas, and then engage in collective responses. So next year, or actually in the coming 12 months, 8 months actually, we're building something called the People's Budget, and we're going to be using these cool processes to engage as many people as possible. We're going to be launching that in a couple of weeks. And in March, we're going to release the People's Budget, which is basically as many people as we can possibly get to share their ideas about how we should be spending the federal budget. And that's just a way of showing governments what other people, really
want.
But in terms of what else can you do, connect with other groups in your society that you will find, whether you're interested in community gardens or health, there's always some groups or advocates who are doing their very best with very little funding often to either...
It always comes back to the community has the answer. Yeah, time and time again. Michelle, thank you so much. It's been fascinating. Lots of people saying this is really interesting. So it's been good to speak with you today.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Michelle Maloney, she is from NENA as well and co-founded, which is, stands for the New Economy Network of Australia. Couple of texts here was one saying this is all just, you know, lefty buzzwords, and another saying well-being, it's such a broad brush. What's the definition of well-being? I mean, now we're getting deep, really, aren't we? What's the definition of well-being?
It's the point, though, isn't it? And because it's so broad, it makes it easy to apply it to whatever the issue is that you're passionate about, right? If you're passionate about better dental care, you're going to say well-being includes dental care. If you're passionate about the environment, you're going to say, and maybe the government's not doing enough for climate change as a reason, you're going to be saying that their well-being is improving the laws around that part of the world, isn't it? And that's probably what makes it interesting when we talk about how defining well-being works and how you relate that to our economy.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Rochelle Hunt with you, and Warwick Long was in Shepparton as always. We're talking about a well-being budget, a well-being economy. What comes first, the well-being or the economy? You know, it's kind of chicken or egg, really, was. If you want a good economy, does our well-being have to be great? You know, because we all feel a bit better when... You know, right, when you're really, really broke, when you're really, really sick, when you feel just like everything is stacked against you, your well-being just diminishes greatly. So, you know, what comes first, economy or well-being?
And how does it all work together? And if you decide to make changes in that space, how does that work? Phil has called from the Gold Coast via Bendigo. I love that description. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Warwick. How are you going?
I'm good. What did you want to add?
Well, I've worked in mental health for many years, working with people with serious mental illness and you know, working with them in a psychosocial sense to get help them get employment, housing, things like that. But what we were guided by was a Vic Health model. It was developed under the leadership of Peter Moody, and essentially it has these determinants: social inclusion, freedom from discrimination and violence, and access to economic resources or financial inclusion. If we can work with people on those things and provide those, that not only for people with mental illness, but for our broader community, adds to overall well-being.
And do you think if it's put into the budget, right, if it's formalised in some way, even though some people may roll their eyes and they may say, oh, this is just yoga mat, incense burning, you know, rubbish, whatever, in the field of work that you do, if it's put into the budget, does it give more weight to making sure that all of the funding, that all of the services are there?
I think, Rochelle, that even with the existing budget, I mean, we can always do with more money, but even with the existing budget, if our GPs, our social workers, even our community members, mayors, local government councillors, and our politicians actually were really educated on those determinants, I think even having it in the back of their mind all the time would actually make a difference in the decision making that they make.
Yeah, and especially Phil, when it comes from someone like you, right, when you're on the front line and you're working with people when their well-being is at their lowest, then you know the reality. You know, we might say this is a middle class well-being mumbo jumbo, but you know that firsthand. Thank you so much for the work that you do. And was, you know, Phil just mentioned their social workers as well. And earlier we had a text saying, well, we've got to teach kids, you know, toddlers right from the very beginning, what well-being is, what it looks like, and how to look after yourself first. It's almost like, you know, apply your own oxygen first before you can help others. It gets used time and time again.
On the plane. You know what? Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a metaphor we can all get behind, isn't it, Rochelle? Interesting ideas, though. Go to Jess Sanders, who's a social worker and author, latest book, You Are Enough. Jess, welcome to The Conversation Hour.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
When we say well-being budget or well-being economy to you, what comes to mind?
I guess when I think about well-being, my mind does go directly to schools and young people. And obviously that is where my focus is as a social worker and a writer. And I think, you know, we just don't know what we don't know. And for a lot of us, when we talk about well-being, sometimes there are parts of well-being that are just missing from our knowledge base. We might not have the awareness or the understanding of mental health or even just how we work as humans. That knowledge isn't always common knowledge. And I think there's a huge opportunity in primary schools, in early education, in high schools, to empower young people with the tools to cater to their own well-being and support themselves and also inform the decisions that we're all talking about when it comes to the economy.
Well, because at the end of the day, they're our leaders. They're our future leaders. So if we can learn from our mistakes of not putting our well-being first. There's a wonderful part in your book, Jess, which is directed at toddlers. You know, it's something for carers or parents to read to a small person. And halfway through the book, it says, you know, if your well-being or if you're feeling overwhelmed, take a moment to just stop, put your hand on your chest and breathe. And something I'm paraphrasing here, but it's sort of like, let's do it now. So for both the person reading and the small person, in the middle of a storybook, you take deep breaths. And I just thought there was something super basic and incredible about that. And just teaching small children to be aware of their own self and their own well-being. And I just wonder how much that changes our lives long term.
Yeah, well, I think that when we have an essentially stopping and breathing and regulating is, you know, having that awareness of our nervous system and our limitations as human beings. I think sometimes we forget we're human beings in the body and we have these like ancient nervous systems that are wired in ways that don't necessarily they're not compatible with how we live now. And so I think we need to return to simple things like, you know, returning to our body and understanding how to breathe and calming our nervous system so that we can make the best decisions for ourselves or so that we can feel well. And I think sometimes we kind of bypass all of that and sometimes overcomplicate that kind of well-being, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, it makes sense. And it's something that we're teaching more and more. So when we talk about how serious we take well-being, it's being put in the budget and it's being introduced into schools a lot. When I explained to my daughter what today's show was about, she said, oh, yeah, no, we do well-being as a subject, Mum, you know, so which is certainly something that wouldn't have been in our school. Just finally, Jess, your work as a social worker, where does well-being and a well-being budget come into a young person's life?
I think it should come into, I guess, the resources that we are giving young people in schools and also into the training that you know, the important people in their life, so their teachers and educators, are also invested in them, in their learning and understanding, so it can then be trickled down and passed on to young people. Because I think that there's a real, I don't know, inconsistency in knowledge bases, and there are some schools doing amazing work in the wellbeing space and there are others that don't maybe have the qualified professionals there or the resources. And so I guess I'd like to see that budget invested into streamlining wellbeing and also into teacher training and just making this area something that is really well understood and that is equal for all young people.
And that's interesting to me, Jess, the idea that we've been talking about what well-being means and all these people saying this connects to this, this connects to that. What you're talking about is actual well-being training, like well-being, the term being actually something that's measurable and that people can use within a school environment to try and make sure their students have better lives.
Exactly, yes. It is probably the most holistic kind of term and thing, and it touches everything, doesn't it?
And I wonder, you know, if those in years to come, right, in decades to come, that are running our country that have been trained in well-being from toddlers, whether or not parliament sittings would look different and whether or not budgets will look different. Who knows? One can only hope. Jess Sanders, thanks so much for your time. As we said, your latest book, You Are Enough. Plenty of texts on this. Similar to what Jess said, one says it starts with self-care, I think, things like just eating and sleeping, etc. Another just saying looking
but
after
when
your...
But we talk about the budget. How do you do that? Like, you can't give people sort of money to eat and sleep better, can you? And would we want that as a society?
I know. And that's the thing, right, where we confuse what well-being is. And well, another says well-being and happiness are two different things. So how connected and how different are they? But I can remember having this really heated discussion with someone who said money's not important, right? It's not important to your happiness. But I fought back and said, well, that's probably because you've never been broke. And you've never understood the connection between having no money and how it affects your well-being and happiness. It's similar to having access to care, to dental care, to GPs have come up time and time again as well.
Yeah, let's bring in Graham, who's called from Melbourne. Graham, what would you like to add?
Well, I think that many of the callers, including the two presenters, have taken a rather negative view about well-being. I'd like to say you've focused far too much on the well-being of the individual rather than the well-being of the society. So if, for example, the well-being of the society could be, for example, how many unwanted teenage pregnancies do we have? How many young people are incarcerated? How many people have suicided in the past year? How many people are homeless? How many people are not completing tertiary education? If you took societal indices, you could measure why do we have such a high rate of incarceration?
100%.
Why do we have such a poor finishing of school and so on? You could then.
But that's a part of the well-being economy and budget. This is exactly what New Zealand has did. And over the last couple of years, because Jacinda Ardern wanted to reduce the suicide rate in New Zealand, and over the last 4 years, unfortunately, even though she's introduced a well-being budget, it hasn't changed the rate of people that are dying by suicide.
The last government said going to change all sorts of things that made no difference. There's been growing equality of our society with funds transferring to the rich and reduced income and wealth of the poorest 10% of the population. Just because Jacinda Ardern did not make an achievement in that area doesn't mean you shouldn't attempt to improve societal well-being. If we could do that, it might have different approach to restorative justice, different approach to suicide prevention, different approach to teenage pregnancies and child well-being and malnutrition. There are starving children in Australia. Well, if that is so, I think you can focus the budget on important societal deficiencies.
And thank you for providing examples, Graham, of what you would like to measure and where you see the importance lies. I'll go back to my very negative colleague, Rochelle Hunt, on the idea of well-being.
Graham raises a good point. No, I 100% agree with Graham. And fundamentally, all of the things that he just listed are measurable measures, if that is a term, of a society that is well, yes, and that's how you can measure well-being. It's just whether or not that will come in to the budget. It's currently not being measured, you know, a lot of those things, like, you know, those under 18 that are incarcerated, our First Nations people that are incarcerated at a higher rate, all of that stuff we already know, but we don't sort of measure it when it comes to well-being.
And, of course, we mention all the time that a good number when we're having conversations like this to have on your phone is Lifeline, which is 13 11 14. And just talking about those measurables that Graham was bringing up there too, Rochelle, the idea that you measure them and then how do you link the economy or how do you attempt to link the economy and the budget to changing what those numbers are saying, to moving them in the direction that you and society wants you to move them in. And that's the difficult thing when we talk about an idea of a well-being budget.
Is it just the word well-being, right?
Yeah, it is.
Because, I mean, there's something here that says deep breaths and well-being exercises don't help you when you don't have access to basic care and education. What if it was a different word? I don't know what the word is, but I think well-being, we all roll our eyeballs a little bit at that term now because it's been used and abused by those that don't necessarily care about your well-being.
And if it was another word, it would be used and abused as well and your eyes would roll just as heavily. Maybe, Rochelle, I don't know.
Dr. Stephen Carbone is a former GP. He's the current CEO and founder of Prevention United. Stephen, let's go back to when you wore your hat as a GP. There has been multiple calls and texts today linking our well-being to access to a doctor, to a GP. How interconnected are our well-being and access to services when it comes to, just to be able to see a GP?
Oh, look, absolutely. But I think we have to be careful of, you know, these sort of false dichotomies. It's we're sort of suggesting that you're either focusing on well-being or you're focusing on services. But really what a well-being budget will do is focus on both. It's about looking at upstream factors and you know, part of my work as a GP was about health promotion and mental health promotion. actually trying to keep people physically and mentally well, as much as then trying to respond to and help them through, you know, any sort of illness or condition that they were dealing with. So the two things go side by side and are interconnected. And of course, you have to spend government funding on both, on wellbeing and primary prevention, as well as treatment, effective treatment in a holistic and comprehensive way.
So you're effectively saying we can walk and chew gum, right? We can handle the economy and we could also focus on things like wellbeing.
Exactly. I mean, this is the problem. We tend to have this narrow downstream view that it's about spending on services, and we forget that, you know, people develop conditions for a reason. And if we don't look at those factors, those upstream factors, those drivers of poor physical and mental health, then we're always going to be sort of winding up treating more and more people. I mean, we've seen that in the mental health area just recently. The ABS released the latest data from the National Study of Mental Health and Wellbeing. And Australia's going backwards, not forwards, in terms of the prevalence of mental ill health, particularly amongst young people, even though, to its credit, more successive governments have spent a lot on services, maybe not enough, and there's still plenty of room for improvement. But on a per capita basis, we've seen some steady increase in growth. So the problem is we need to start asking, well, okay, let's keep our services going and boost those and improve those for sure, absolutely. But what else can we add to the equation? Not what do we take away or what do we swap, or but what can we add? And a focus on the upstream, on understanding what drives people's mental health and wellbeing, and then what we can do for those inputs will then make a big difference, because it adds to what we're already doing.
And I guess if you flip it and you look at what bad health costs us first, you know, I'm no economist, far from it, and thank goodness for that, because I don't even know my times tables, but, you know, bad health would cost the economy, would cost us a lot of money.
That's right. And I think it's what you were alluding to earlier in the program, that there are actually very solid scientific measures of wellbeing. Yes, it can sound a bit fluffy sometimes the way it's spoken about it, but there's a solid science behind it. And there are wellbeing measures both at an individual level and, as your previous caller was saying, at a community or a societal level. How do we measure what's going well and what's not going well individually, socially, economically? But what we find is that it is chicken and egg, as you say, but good mental health and wellbeing, for example, is a driver of productivity. You know, people who have high levels of mental wellbeing, the science shows this, perform better academically, are more creative, they're more productive, they contribute more to society, but more importantly, they're healthier, both physically and mentally, and so they use less services. On the flip side, when you're languishing or you've got a significant mental health challenge, you're going to need services. And of course, you know, that comes at a cost. But also it makes it harder for you to participate in the workforce and make that contribution. So the Productivity Commission, now, you know, this is mind-boggling stuff, estimated that the cost of mental ill health in the community was $200 to $220 billion per year.
Gosh.
So, you know, that's a lot of money we could be saving if we were looking at ways to actually avert poor mental health and wellbeing and actually improve people's lives so they were productive and less likely to become unwell and require expensive services.
So just quickly, if you were in charge of our wellbeing budget, what would be the simple change you would make to have the greatest impact on society?
Well, I think like the New Zealand budget, I mean, this, you know, we need to start at the source, and they spend a lot of time and energy looking at how to improve or give young people, children and young people, the best start to life. A lot of the seeds of poor physical and mental health actually start in childhood. If you're exposed to social disadvantage, to child abuse, to domestic violence, the odds of you having major physical and mental health problems in the future are really, really high. So they've focused on child poverty, they've focused on the early years, and I think, you know, that's a good place to start. I mean, it's not the only thing we should be investing in, don't get me wrong, but, you know, if you tell me I'd only have one thing, I'd put my money towards better
Can we put you in charge? We need to give you a little bit more power. It's fascinating. We're out of time, but it's been really good getting your thoughts on this today, Stephen. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks,
Michelle. That's Dr. Stephen Carbone. He's formerly a GP, but he's now the CEO and founder of Prevention United. And that's a pretty perfect title, isn't it? Prevention United. And all of those elements, even Graham that rang before, you know, wholeheartedly agree. And I'm not cynical because I don't think it's important, was, right? Far from it. I'm so passionate about this, the health and the well-being of every single one of us. I'm cynical only because if you throw a word in, does it mean that it is of focus and that anything will change?
Well, you better get used to it, Rochelle, because you're my Minister for Wellbeing for now on, okay?
You're in deep trouble, my friend.
A wellbeing budget, a wellbeing economy. It is fascinating to look at, though, because there are and people are actually referring to this on the text line, and Graham was too, the idea of individual well-being, societal well-being, and if you're looking at the numbers behind that, how do you set up a budget? How do you set up an economy to keep that in mind? And is that going to benefit us?
That's it for the Conversation Hour today. Thanks so much for listening. I'll speak to you soon.